only slightly healthy edition of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. I'm your host, Jeff Bowdrin. With me, my co-host, the Midnight Rambler from Ambler, Barry Rose. How are you doing today, Barry?
I'm living the dream. How you doing?
Oh, you know, here on this show, I always like to say we break cave on pop culture and life. This episode will be heavy on life because lots of things in life for us to discuss today. Oh, we're going to be looking wait a minute. Sponsor alert. We have a sponsor for the next few episodes. We'll be getting to that in a second. What? And we will be looking for a match from the past. We're going back to, I believe, 1982, Barry, to an area I do not believe we have ever covered a match from this part of the country, this territory. So I'm really super stoked because one of my favorite, it's a tag team match, one of my favorite underrated tag team of the 80s is involved in this match. We will continue our popular discussion of the top 1,000 classic rock songs of all time. We get a lot of good feedback on that. And let's see, we're going to talk about a TV show that Barry and I are really, really enjoying and getting a super huge kick out of. We'll be talking about that. Barry, before we do, it's time for a health update. Not just from Mr. Bowdrin, but my family's going through some real shit. How do I tell you? Literally and figuratively, Barry. So yesterday, your favorite host here decided or was ordered by his doctor to go get a CAT scan on the old abdomen because I have good days and bad days. Let's put it that way. But I have essentially had problems eating anything. I'm not getting enough to drink. So, you know, it's nice to lose a little weight, Barry. Not the most encouraging way to lose weight. So while I'm sporting I'm probably down to about a 12 pack. I don't have a 6-pack weight yet. How about a 12 pack, maybe a pony keg. So one of the things you do when you go get a CAT scan is you go in and they make you drink this stuff that's called Contrast. And they give you a couple different options on flavors. So I got the pink lemonade flavor. And this is the shittiest tasting pink lemonade you've ever had. It's like when you get a sugar-free powdered lemonade and it just, it's not like drinking, you know, liquid death, but it's not good. Let's put it that way. So I drink it and then I got to wait 30 to 45 minutes and they bring you into this thing. And it sort of looks, it's not quite like an MRA. It's just like a big donut hole. And they put you into this thing. You got to hold your breath a couple times. They take pictures of your abdomen and they send them off. My doctor hopefully will get back to me by Monday and let me know what it is. I have my suspicions. My wife has done the Google search and has told me what she thinks it is, but the doctor maybe will confirm it for me on Monday. So I get home. Here we go, Barry. I'm going to tell the folks it's a near Ethiopian story from Mr. Rose. And you know where I'm going here, Barry. So as I was telling Barry before we started recording, I'm sitting on the couch and I'm home from the doctor's and I got to take my dog to the vet like about 3 hours after this. Okay. And I'm even to the point where I'm considering canceling the vet appointment, but I know I can't do that because my dog's having a situation, let's just say, that we need to have taken care of. So I'm sitting there in the chair and Barry, as I told you, you know, sometimes you're about to pop the old silent but deadly. And then at the last second, you realize this is going to be deadly, but it's not going to be silent. And there may be a little more to it. That's what happened to Mr. Bowdrin. I had a near Ethiopian-like situation. So I'm doing the dash to the bathroom. And I got there and all hell broke loose. Except then I checked and saw I really didn't quite make it all the way to the bathroom. Oh. If you know what I'm talking about. The first time, I believe, since I was 3 that I've had that incident happen to me. So, yeah. So then later, I confess to the bride. I say, yeah, you know, I got to be honest with you. Here's what happened. She was like, oh, yeah, well, you know, I drank Contrast before for a CAT scan. And that's what happens. You have awful diarrhea for the entire day.
Oh,
no one bothered to tell me that. So that situation resolved. So I'm still feeling queasy in the stomach from the Contrast. And now I got to take my dog to the vet. OK, so I'm sitting there. Thankfully, the vet we know very well. She's a very sweet woman. And as she's telling me about what's wrong with my dog, I'm sitting there going, oh, God, please don't have to fart. Please don't have to fart, because if I shit myself in front of this woman, I'm never returning to this vet's office ever again. Oh, Barry. And I didn't even have the Ethiopian food.
She'd be fine with it, too.
Oh,
she'd
I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
Clean up in room 4.
Exactly.
There, a dog, by the way. It's the owner. Yeah.
Dog owner, doesn't matter. They're used to urine and fecal matter on the floor and clean it up. They'd have no problem.
One thing we know about our listeners, Barry, they love a good fecal story. We have people that are a little too obsessed with shit in this group. So, yeah. So I got that going on. I got my father going to have surgery in about 2 or 3 weeks. And found out the other day, my brother going in as the day this drops, it'll be the day before, quadruple bypass.
Oh,
oh my God. What a hell.
It's all happening in one shot.
All the men in my family are like falling to hell, you know. But yeah. I will say one thing. I want to mention one thing positively. Member of the group, my brother-in-law, Kent Morris, and I told the group many months ago that my brother-in-law was going in. He had some surgery. And my brother-in-law, believe it or not, has been in, I don't know what they call it. He's not in a hospital. He's in a long-term care facility at this point. And he's been in there. He finally, as of the other day, got off the ventilator and has begun a normal eating routine again. He's been in now, so how long? 6 months, the wife says. 6 months. So what I'd like to do, I'm gonna post his name. His name is Kent Morrison. He's a member of our group. And I would encourage everyone, because Kent is, now that he's off the ventilator, he's, you know, you got to have stuff to stimulate you and keep your mind going and stuff like that. And I was telling Barry before we started recording, I can't even imagine being on a ventilator where you can't speak, you know, and share your thoughts with people. So I just want to ask people in the group to reach out to my brother-in-law, Kent, within our group, you know, wish him well. Tell him to hang in there, because he's doing better. And as I told you, Barry, he's dropped 140 pounds.
Wow.
He was a big guy. You know, he was over four bills, but man, he's dropped 135. That's a whole person that he dropped off his back, Bear.
Yeah. So he's down to what, like 265 in that neighborhood. So yeah, it's amazing too. What a nice guy too. I met him at your daughter's wedding, and just a real gentleman, a real gentle guy. As a matter of fact, I really enjoyed him, but I'm so happy to hear too, that he's getting better. And, you know, it sucks too. You've got all this going on with, you know, your family members and yourself. It doesn't end. And fingers crossed that everybody is good with this. Jeff, the one thing that you are going to have to really embrace at this moment, hopefully, is, and I'm willing to share, Jeff, is the abuse you take over shitting your pants. Because it's, if you...
Let me just clarify. It was not a full-on shit.
It was a little bit. You still, that classifies as you shitting your pants. And I'm willing
to be honest about one another, you know?
Yes, absolutely. Look, it's we've been, what episode is this? What are we at?
127. This is the shitty episode. That's what we're going to call it.
So we're almost 2.5 years. We've never missed a week. And the legacy after 2.5 years is basically shit. Is exactly what it is.
Literally and figuratively, probably.
Yes, you are now fully part of that. So good. It's almost a cause for celebration in many ways.
Truly. So I will just lastly say that my brother-in-law, Kent, huge NASCAR guy. So any NASCAR fans in the group, feel free to reach out to him. He loves a good NASCAR conversation. So you got that going for you. So now, Barry, let's go on to... our sponsor, Ian Totten. Thank you, Ian, my man. Once again, Ian has a new book coming out. It is called Throwaway Girls of Olympia. Barry, why don't you tell the folks, and I'll follow up with it, on some of the stuff that Ian has written in his latest novel.
Yeah, you know, Ian is, first off, we got to say, Ian is one of us. And it's
his pants, too?
I don't know if he's ever good in mid shitting.
We'll have to get to Ian to confirm that or deny that.
Yeah, and I don't know if he has. I met Ian about a year ago. It was actually during the last WrestleMania, the same day. We were at a fan fest, and great guy, just warm, friendly, but he's also one of us. I think when it comes to it, he basically, Ian and I had conversations during when we were promoting his last, which was The House of Silver Doors, his last book. And he said that, you know, advertising on Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry was huge for him. And a lot of that goes to our listeners who also support Ian, because he is one of us. But I wanted to read this, and this is how much I like Ian as well. So I have a copy of the book, and I'm reading the back jacket. So I'm going to read you a brief synopsis of what it's about, and then I want to read you how Ian describes himself, which I absolutely love. Sheriff Alan O'Toole has a problem. Someone is murdering the young women in the small town of Olympia, Iowa. Something about this spate of killings has the sheriff troubled. However, the victims look too much like his late daughter, Amy, for his liking. With a nagging ex-wife wanting to sell their old house and a son refusing to get a job to support himself, O'Toole is at his wits' end. When his senator friend involves an FBI agent, he thinks it's just to point him in the right direction. As the case progresses, O'Toole begins to realize his kind of on-the-street police work is a dying breed, And the agent, with his more scientific approach, represents the future. With the summer heating up and the body count rising, both men begin to suspect they'll never catch the faceless killer, leaving young women on the side of the road like bags of trash. Truly sounds like one of the stories that we cover in Unsolved Mysteries, Jeff. But let me read you how he describes himself, which I just, this right here says this guy's a brother to us. Husband, father, best-selling author and ghostwriter of horror, dark fantasy, and fiction, Ian Totten is an all-around strange dude with a passion for the disturbing, macabre, and old wrestling. I mean, right there. It's like he's like our like triplet of the twin brothers right there.
If this was John McAdams' show, he'd already had him on as a guest, you know, but
there you go. Good point.
So, but no, it looks like a very, and I will be honest with you. As I mentioned before we started recording, I reached out to Ian and said, dude, I've been sicker than a dog for the last week or so. Could you just give me a 2-paragraph synopsis? And he was very kind enough to send me a synopsis of the books. And you're right, Barry. It is right up our alley on the kind of stuff we cover in Unsolved Mysteries. You know, you got cops on the edge. You got the squeaky clean FBI guy. You got a serial killer that's preying on women in this small town. Shit, this could be an Unsolved Mysteries episode all by itself, you know? So we would encourage you. Ian Totten is the author. The name of the book is Throwaway Girls of Olympia. Actually, you know, when he sent me the synopsis, it sort of reminded me in a way of the story we did about the girls up in the Vancouver area. Most of them, the indigenous women that were mysteriously being killed, and some of them they found, some they didn't. So,
Jeff, continuing to this day, because if you Google that, it is still going on. If for whatever reason, they haven't made any progress. There are still indigenous women up in that area, up in Canada, that are disappearing on a daily basis. And for whatever reason, the government's looking the other way and not being able to make any headway with this, which just says to me, there's more to this story than meets the eye. But Jeff, I do want to point a couple things out. Ian has written several other books. He wrote the Blood God trilogy, which consisted of 3 books, which is Heart of Man, Gods of Fear, and The Birth of Death. Obviously, The House of Silver Doors. He's got his new book, but I'm going to put him on the spot right here, and I'm going to make an offer to him. Ian is going to be in Tampa during WrestleMania weekend. I believe he's on vacation with his family, but is going to be attending the great debate between Ron Fuller and Bob Roop. And I don't know if Ian can bring books with him. I don't know if he wants to bring books with him, but we'll get some information. But I know Ian will be there. I think that would be great if Ian was able to bring some books and sell them at the Fan Fest. Because again, a lot of our people, they support Ian. They support anybody that we've ever advertised with. And I think it would be great. Ian could, you know, autograph copies and actually sell them there. So Ian, the offer is open for you, my friend.
I will just say that Ian is willing to autograph them. For a personalized autograph, might be a little more money. That's the way that, you know, we roll. Once again, you're absolutely right. Ian is one of us. And by supporting Ian, you're supporting our group. You're supporting people in our group and encouraging perhaps, future endorsements, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe Zaha wants us to endorse Mariano's grocery store.
For
a nominal fee, of course.
Yeah, yes. Hold your breath.
Okay.
And let's see what color you turn before Zaha supports us.
There are a few people that want our support and want their name mentioned as often as possible, but we have not seen a nickel from them, let's just say. So I'm not going to mention any names. You know who you are. So anyway, speaking of throwaway people, Barry, let's talk about your old friend Hannibal and what he's been up to lately. Go ahead. You have the floor.
All right. So let's be honest, too, because I think if anything, I think we do need to be honest about it. Hannibal could probably kick the asses of 80% of the people walking the earth. Maybe that's a high number. But my point being, this guy, I think, is a legitimate badass, though, when it comes down to.
Well, he certainly was to Bruce Cohen.
Exactly. But I think he's an asshole. He's a bully asshole with allegedly a possible drinking problem because his personality does seem to flip.
Speculated.
Rumor has it. I don't have any idea. I have no proof of that, but I've heard that and I feel it's fair to say that. But he has laid his hands on fans, you know, which is completely. But he is a tough guy. He was training for the Olympics. And I know that he's done some shoot fighting. Look, the guy is a legit badass. And I get that. He has also made himself very successful through the magic of YouTube. And because every time you click on a Hannibal link,
a lot of clicks, baby,
a lot of clicks, and he'll encourage you to do that. He is making money. So I give him credit in the fact that, yes, he's a badass. I get it. More power to you if that's how you want to live your life. And the second aspect is for having no fucking talent in the broadcasting field. And I'm not an expert because I don't have a ton of talent in that field either. And I'll be the first one to tell you, he has built a full-time job for himself because that's what he does. His career and his job is clicks on YouTube, and he's getting paid for that. And that actually, he should get props for that. That is where I will end anything positive of this fucking mouth breather. So I was fortunate in that somebody sent me a link this morning, and thank you, by the way, whoever it was, and I forget who it was, so I'm not leaving you out. I just truly do forget. And it was, have you seen this video about Scott Steiner? So a little backstory, Scott Steiner was in Atlanta, where I believe he lives in a suburb, last night.
Didn't call me, but you know, whatever.
And actually, I got to say, Dave Penzer, also in Atlanta last night.
Cash Money, didn't call me.
Yes, they were shooting a special for the Impact or TNA show that they're going to be doing during WrestleMania weekend. And they flew Penzer up, and Penzer was there. But Scott Steiner, I believe, wrestled a match, had an angle, something, got back to the locker room, collapsed. Apparently, his heart stopped breathing. The people thought he died. They rushed.
His heart would stop beating, not breathing.
Oh, yeah. What did I say? Did I say breathing?
You said his heart stopped breathing. So
His heart stopped breathing. That's going to be my new term now. His heart stopped breathing. And he went to the hospital. Apparently, he's okay. But the video was Hannibal giving an update. I believe he said it's 3 o'clock in the morning. He looks like, when you look at him, he's got the charisma of a slug. And he looks like Sloth from Goonies. But Sloth was actually endearing. There, nothing about Hannibal is endearing, but he's giving an update on Scott Steiner based off of information he's taken off the internet. And he credits Dave Meltzer, so I'll give him credit right there as well. And that he says, according to
Dave Meltzer of the Wrestling Observer, Scott Steiner had a heart attack tonight.
The least charismatic human being that may have ever lived at any point, which really says a lot.
Wait a minute, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
More charismatic, Hannibal or Baron Corbin?
Baron Corbin.
Okay, there we go.
And there you go. Holy shit. There you go. Great comparison.
More charisma, Hannibal or Tim Horner?
Tough one. Really? You're narrowing the gap there. I'm still going to go with Tim Horner, but you're narrowing the gap, Jeffrey. But so again, he gives the Observer credit, but all he does is basically says what Dave said, reporting from the Observer. What I found interesting was when he started to take shots at people. Now, I know that there are people in our group that like Hannibal, and I'm not going to pass you, because if you like him, more power to you. I don't give a shit. More power to you. If you think he's offering something that's of benefit to you or whatever, that's great. I think, honestly, I truly believe that. It has no bearing on this conversation at all. What does get me is when Hannibal will insult people, and people, there's a term in wrestling, and I hate the term and I'm going to say it, but there's a term that wrestlers have used, and it's clueless marks. And I hate it because you're insulting the people that support you when you do it. Well, guess the fucking Canadian mouth breathing asshole that just insulted his audience, Jeff. Can you guess who it is?
Does it begin with an H?
It does begin with an H, and it's not asshole. It's Hannibal.
Not Hasselhoff.
No, and I like Hasselhoff. And I actually have a funny story about Hasselhoff, which if you remind me, I'll tell you right after this. But so Hannibal starts off. He takes a shot at Scott D'Amore, who I believe is the booker and head in charge of Impact right now, and takes a shot at him. And I have to assume that Scott D'Amore, being Canadian, has somehow wronged Hannibal. Maybe Hannibal wanted, got to remember too, Hannibal has never worked for a major promotion. He doesn't work for Impact. So if he's a really great wrestler, you got to remember, he's never worked for a major promotion. So there's a reason if he is a really great wrestler. He's either not really a great wrestler or he's just a fucking nightmare to deal with. I'm going to say it's both of those, Jeff, but I don't know because I've never seen one of his matches. So takes a shot at Scott D'Amore. He then takes several shots at Impact in TNA wrestling, brings up that he once rode in a car with Scott Steiner, who was also taking shots at TNA Impact Wrestling. But then, of course, he takes shots at internet wrestling fans. And basically, I'd have to go back and watch it, and I'll post this in the Facebook group, but I'll go back and watch it, and I don't know if he does call them clueless marks, but he does take shots at internet wrestling fans. And considering he makes his living from internet wrestling fans, if you still support this fucking douche nozzle, you are a clueless mark. He has just insulted you. If you're an internet wrestling fan, you just got insulted. However, you're paying his bills. You're paying this fucking asshole's bills by every time you click on one of his YouTube videos. That's how you support this guy. So your call, how you want to handle this, if you want to continue, again, doesn't mean shit to me, but it infuriates me because it's always infuriated me, Jeff, when people within the business, it's maybe my biggest pet peeve when wrestlers insult their fans by either calling them marks, clueless marks, whatever it is. I have had, and I hand to God on this one, I have had wrestlers contact me and ask if they could advertise and post their stuff in my CWF group because I, quote unquote, have a lot of marks in there. And I don't have to tell you how quickly I remove that person from my group and how quickly I would never let them push anything. It's, again, when you are a professional wrestler and within the wrestling industry and you publicly tell somebody that, oh, the marks or the clueless marks, and, you know, let's see how much money I can squeeze out of them. Go fuck yourself. Because that to me is the biggest sign of disrespect. And I know it exists. I know in the old days it really exists. And I know it exists, and nothing will get me as mad at that. However, there's video. It was posted last night by Sloth at 3:30 a.m. of him calling fans marks and internet marks, and he does take a shot at him. So it really does tick me off. And certainly I've got issues with the guy, and I'll be the first one to tell you I'm biased. I have a total bias against this fucking asshole. Yes, I do. I have no problem with that. But for him to take shot at the people who support him, and sadly that those people will continue to support him, that's on them. That's not on me, Jeff.
You know what? Instead of supporting Sloth, that's a great nickname for him, by the way, with his little clicks and looking at one of his videos, which, by the way, I can honestly say I have never seen one of his videos. Instead of supporting him, support a good guy like Ian Totten. That's the kind of people you should be supporting.
Support a guy that would support you.
Exactly.
And at the end of the day, if fucking Ian Totten, when I say fucking Ian Totten, I say that endearingly, by the way, he's coming to my fan fest all the way from the Northeast. I believe he's in New Jersey. He's supporting what we do. He listens to every episode. He's advertised with this. What the fuck has Hannibal ever done for anybody other than himself? Certainly Billy Graham. He's enabled Billy Graham on many different levels. But in any form, what has he ever done for you?
Yeah,
other than insult you?
If you have any questions about Hannibal, why don't you reach out in the group and ask Bruce Cohen? Say, Bruce, what do you think of Hannibal? Give yourself some time because there's going to be a kind of a lengthy answer. So and I will describe him only in a word that people in the group seem to like when I used it previously. Why are you helping this fuck stick? You know, I mean,
yeah,
you know, flush him down the fuck.
This is where you get your news.
He is equal to what was in my pants yesterday. Let's put it that way.
You get your news. I'm going to log on to the internet because Hannibal is where I'm going to get my news. Even though he tells you Dave Meltzer's reporting.
Yeah.
Go to the fucking.
But people won't support Meltzer because he's an employee of AEW.
Right.
Don't even. Hannibal, much more reliable than Dave Meltzer.
Oh, yeah.
Fucking. So let's go on to slightly more interesting stories than Hannibal. Right. It isn't even that. So let's talk about friend of the show, group member Brett Julian, and what happened to him recently. Delivered an order of pizzas to someone, $640 worth, zero tip. So the first thing before I ask you your opinion of this, as someone who's been in the restaurant industry, Barry, couldn't help remember the Office episode with was it Pizzas by Alfredo or Alfredo's Pizza?
Yes.
Which one would you prefer? So Barry, first of all, let's talk about $640 and you don't give anyone a gratuity is completely fucking insane.
Yeah, slight correction on that too, Jeff. Either you or I are dyslexic, but it was, I believe it was $460.
Okay, I'm sorry.
So, but it could be me. I could be the one who's dyslexic. So,
well, we'll let the audience decide that, mister.
I'm not really sure. But so why don't we look through it? So first off, and I don't know this, there is a chance that this was a mistake and an error, because maybe the person that he was delivering to thought the tip had been taken care of and rolled up into one. I can tell you, spending more years in the hospitality, food and beverage industry than I would ever care to admit in way too long, was that sometimes people did forget to tip and it was by accident. When I point that out, and I'll give a quick, my wife actually worked for a major steakhouse chain, a Central Florida steakhouse chain in the mid 90s when we lived in Orlando. And she came home one night and she was in tears, and she had taken care of a group of six businessmen from out of town. The check was, and this is 96, the check was somewhere in upwards of $800, and they did not give her a tip. And she came home, she was in tears. And the next day she went to work and the guy realized it and actually said, I'm going to stop by the restaurant and give you a cash tip. I didn't realize this till I left. And this was self-awareness of himself. Sure. So nothing that had been pointed out. But I can tell you, this also happened when I was managing restaurants, that I would, you know, occasionally somebody would go, I feel terrible. I thought so-and-so was taking care of the tip. It didn't happen. And the result was Brett Julian got fucked out of, you know, if he's making a delivery and it's $460, I would say, you know, he's good for at least $50, if not more. So it could have been an honest mistake. That being said, Jeff, if it wasn't an honest mistake and we don't know the truth on that one, this person should really rot in hell. Because first off, people who are tipped, and look, you've seen Midnight Run. Tom Hale watching Midnight Run for the first time this past week and saying,
what's the matter with you, Tom? How did you not get to that movie?
Tom, what the F? I take Tom by the shoulders and I shake him like this, Jeff. And I say, what the hell has taken you so many years? But Tom Hale finally seeing it and recognizing the greatness. But there's a great scene in there where Charles Grodin explains to Robert De Niro about tipped employees. And it is true, because tipped employees make their living, guess what, on being tipped. If the service sucks, you have every right to either reduce or withhold the tip if you felt something's wrong. But if somebody is doing their job, which means, you know, Brett was delivering pizzas, you have an obligation. You have a moral obligation to fucking tip these people. And by not doing that, we never know, can these people pay their bills? They're not working for free, so you can get $460 or $640 worth of pizza. So again, I want to think that this was an honest error. But again, I think he said a couple of things that may lead us to believe that maybe it wasn't an honest error. And I feel for him, because there's nothing as disheartening as thinking you're going to be paid for the job that you're doing and you're not being paid for it.
Well, again, sometimes in life, you have to go to the source of where you can get all life's information. And that, of course, is Jerry Seinfeld. I'm watching Seinfeld the other night. And of course, they had the triple header episode where they went to Los Angeles, George and Jerry, and they're in the backseat of a squad car because Kramer's been arrested as a serial killer. And so the cops arrest Clint Howard and they're sitting in the backseat and Clint Howard is handcuffed. And so George looks at the guy and he says, hey, how much do you think you should tip a chambermaid per night? And Clint Howard, $5. And George says, $5? That's ridiculous. Maybe $1. Ah, that's crazy. You give them $5. They're working hard for their money. And of course, at the end of the show, they realized that the guy they'd been in the backseat with is actually the serial killer. And they said, he's 5'8" and he reportedly is a very good tipper. So, that was a classic episode. And when you started telling that story, I just flashed back to I think he was called the Smog Killer or something like that.
Yeah. But, that was that was a two-parter, one of the rare two-part episodes, if I remember correctly. So Jeff, I want to go back to something that you said inadvertently at the very beginning of the show, of the recording. And I don't know if it's because I'm partially hearing impaired or you said it, but when you said breaking kayfabe, it sounded like you were saying breaking kayfay. And it made me think immediately of the first time I ever heard the term kayfabe. Do you remember your first time hearing that term?
Oh, God.
Ooh, right?
Put me on the spot. I think Brother Jeff Steele.
What year are you thinking?
Oh, this is like mid-80s.
Gotcha.
Because he mentioned it, and I asked him, I said, what the hell is that? And he kind of, you know, to me, kayfabe is like aloha. It has like right. many different meanings, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Shalom. Yeah. Aloha. Yeah. You're right.
We'll be getting to shalom later in the show. And a question about that comment. So next story we're going to get to, Barry, is the one that I've kept from you until now. I told you there was a topic I wanted to discuss, and I got this for you because I think this is a really, really good talking point. Barry, let us break it. First time in about a year and a half, we've broke kayfabe on weddings. Because I have a story that I want to share with you that was told to me last night by a very good friend of mine from South Florida who actually listens to the show.
Somebody I know?
Somebody you met at my daughter's wedding, as a matter of fact. I'm not going to say her name.
It's not one of the South Florida crew, though.
No.
Okay, gotcha.
But it's someone who I care about very much. She's a very good friend, and I miss you very much, by the way. So this friend of mine was telling me that she had a wedding that she was involved with. And so, you know, my wife and I, of course, went down to South Florida last week to we would stop to see my father and went to see Kim's brother. It was very last minute. And as it turned out, there was a family wedding. And she, you know, she commented to me, oh, my God, if I'd known that you were going to be down here, I would, of course, you know, you would have had an invitation. And she even said, if you want to come to the wedding, it's fine. And I said, no, this was very last minute. You know, don't worry about it. And my wife and I went on her her daughter's what do they call it? The gift list where you you sign up at different department stores. Why can't I think of it right now? But anyway,
registered. You got to be registered.
Right. Yes. That's right. So we, you know, my wife picked out a few things and we sent her daughter a few gifts. And she sent me a note saying it was very thoughtful of you, considering you weren't at the wedding. It was a very nice gesture on your part. So then she proceeds to tell me that there were people that were at the wedding that did not bring a gift. She says, here you were. You didn't even go to the wedding and you were thoughtful enough to, you know, to send my daughter some gifts. And here were people that I will just say family members of her who were there, who brought their children, a group of, I want to say between 5 and 7 people. And there was no gift. Barry, have you ever been involved? First question, have you ever gone to a wedding and not brought a gift of any sort?
No, I don't think so. I mean, okay. That doesn't make sense.
Have you ever, you know, when you married your lovely bride, did you have anyone that was invited or came to your wedding who did not give you a gift?
Honestly, I don't. It's almost 22 years ago. I don't think so. I think everybody did. But yeah, I'm not really sure.
OK, so which brings me to the meat of my story, besides the first part of the story, which is, I think, pretty reprehensible. When my wife Kim and I got married, of course, I've told it before, this is my third wedding to Kim, my last wedding, I assure you.
The best one, too.
My wife's making faces at me.
Yes.
Put down the gun, honey. Put down the gun.
But, wow. And then silence.
My wife told me something, and I shouldn't mention my wife's email is Jeff's third wife. My dad said, shouldn't it be Jeff's last wife? I said, let's not get ahead of ourselves, Dad. But anyway, so when we got married, I had invited a friend of mine who was a former public defender in my division for about a year, who I got to be very, very good friends with, you know, because we were in court with each other every day. At the time that she was my public defender, my marriage to my second wife was ending. And, you know, we were close enough that, you know, she was a confidant. She was a friend. And, you know, I discussed many issues that I was going through with her, you know, with her at the time. And she was, you know, offered very good advice. And, you know, sometimes you just need someone to listen to the event. And was very kind. So, of course, when I got married to Kim, I invited her to the wedding. So she showed up at the wedding and she was seated at a table with one of my best friends, Pat. And so Pat was sitting with her and the other. It was all people from the courthouse and they were chit-chatting. So somehow the subject of wedding gifts comes up. Someone said, oh, what'd you give Jeff and Kim? And, you know, this person said, oh, I gave him this, you know. And, you know, sometimes it's something for the house, something for the kitchen, and sometimes monetary or a gift card, something, you know. And so she sat there and looked at the people in the table. Again, this is an attorney, and said, yeah, I didn't get him anything. I mean, it's his third wedding. What do you give somebody on their third wedding? Mind you, she had never been to either one of my first two weddings. And I had a few people that had been to all three. And quite frankly, if they hadn't chose on the third time to give me a gift, I really would have understood that. I wouldn't have had a problem with that. I will say the people that were at all three of my weddings did, in fact, get us a gift. Okay. But this person who was at the first time she was at any of my weddings had the gall to say, what do you get somebody who's married for the third time?
That person didn't give us anything, you know, and I told Kim, I go, and give us a $25 gift card for God's sake, you know? But anyway, so she did not give us anything. And I will say that I don't think I ever spoke to her again. Not because of that. I just had no contact with her, didn't run into her. She offered no, hey, listen, I didn't know what to get you. You know, I was at a loss. And again, like I said, get somebody a $25 gift card, you know? Or if you're a person who's not financially in a position to get a gift, you know, get somebody a gift card. I mean, that's just ridiculous. Get them a Publix gift card for a few bucks, just so you're giving them something. That's why you're invited to the weddings aren't free, people. Someone's paying for that fucking thing. So now all that being said, Barry, tell us what you think about non-gifters at weddings.
Yeah. So I got to say too, if anybody ever wants to get me a gift, things like Publix gift cards, Jeff, would be a dream come true. It just doesn't make sense why you would not get somebody a gift. It's not what the gift is. It is the gesture of actually bringing a gift, which is the right thing to do. Look, I'm going to a brunch function tomorrow with my wife and kids, and we're bringing something. It's not going to be, you know, it might be a bottle of wine. We may cook a side dish, whatever. You don't show up empty handed to some sort of, you know, but especially a wedding of all things. You're going to go to a wedding or a bar mitzvah. What do weddings cost? $50 a person, $100 a person. That's what they charge. It could be sometimes even more. So that makes no sense. It's rude. It's beyond rude. Hannibal would do something like that.
Yes.
No, absolutely.
We don't call him Hannibal anymore. What do we call him, Barry?
Sloth or Hasshole.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Tell us the Hasselhoff story real quick before we get to our match of the week.
So years ago when I lived in New York City, I used to go to this dry cleaner literally two blocks from where I was. And right next to the dry cleaner was a wine and liquor store. And we used to go to pick up bottles of wine. We were drinking at that time. I don't really drink a whole lot. And one time we ran into David Hasselhoff. He was in the store. So didn't think anything of it. You know, he's in the store. I guess he was in New York City for whatever reason. And we went back the next time and there was a photo on the wall. And David had inscribed, and they had celebrity photos on the wall of all the celebrities that had been in there. 24 hours later, his daughter releases the video of him on the floor with the cheeseburger. You remember that video?
Yes, I do remember that.
And I just remember being with my wife saying, how fucking ironic is this that, you know, we saw David Hasselhoff in a liquor store and now he's on the floor completely out of his mind as a raging alcoholic trying to get a cheeseburger. Like, it was just ironic. So it's not, you know, it's not the greatest story, obviously.
Well, no, but when you first started telling the story and you mentioned you were in a liquor store, I was going, what are the odds of a story about Hasselhoff with a liquor store?
That's it. Know? Yeah. But I guess my point, I didn't see him in the dry cleaners either. I just saw him in the liquor store. So,
okay. So now, folks, it's time for our match of the week.
Oh.
And I have to say, we have never, ever done a match, as far as I can remember. Again, it's 127 episodes in, where we have looked at a match from Georgia. And we're looking, I want to say, I don't have a specific date. It's sometime maybe around July of 1982. We are talking one of my favorite underrated tag teams of the 80s, Masked Superstar and the Super Destroyer. We're talking Bill Eadie and Scott Hog Irwin taking on Paul Orndorff and Tommy Rich, a house show from Columbus, Georgia, promoter Fred Ward, I believe. That was shot from the upper deck or the grandstands. So I don't think this was part of the regular Columbus TV that was still going on at the time. First of all, before we get to the match, four guys that were super over at this time. This is Tommy Rich had kind of started his downward turn with gaining weight and some other issues. But first of all, Mass Superstar and Super D. Wow, what a team they were, Bear.
They were. Look, so this is, we'll talk about this too. But you just said something as well, Jeff. So was this a house show? Was it Columbus TV? Was it being recorded for the television? I know Columbus in the 70s had their own television show. I believe it was in studio, though. This obviously was in the arena. Was it Bell Auditorium or was that in Augusta?
That was in Augusta, I believe.
Where did Columbus? Do you remember where Columbus recorded? Or where the matches were?
No, I can't. I can't remember.
I think Bell was Augusta. You are right.
Sweet Lou, you're on the job there.
Oh, the Green Bomb's going to make a comment about that.
Yeah, of course. But yeah. I digress. I digress, Joshua.
Oh, yeah. That's a great segue there, Jeff.
I am the king of segues, but anyway.
You are the king of segues. We're pulling them all out right now. Green Bomb, giving you material, my friend. So do it. But
he'll post it 6 days from from after the show drops. That's usually what he does.
But. Yeah, that's it. When he's angry, when he's a little angry, he'll go ahead and post it. But so I don't know. I know that they did their own television recordings with Fred Ward in the 70s. This obviously is in a TV studio, but there is commentators. So I don't know. The other aspect is this match doesn't appear to have any sort of buildup to it. Like, it just appears you're taking four of the top guys in the territory, if not the top four guys in the territory, and they're having a match. So it's a little bizarre that way. It's a very good match, but there's nothing about it that really stands out. But so for me, I think I have less notes on this and more questions that came to mind as I was watching. So Nick Patrick is the referee here. Does
very young.
Very young. And Nick Patrick, Georgia, guy who lives in Georgia. Paul Orndorff. So a couple of thoughts on this right here. Paul Orndorff wearing the tights that have his initials that say OP on them. I never quite understood the logic. I think it was explained that the P comes first, even though it was lower. I forget exactly. But when you look, you see there's OP on the back of his shorts. Orndorff Paul. Maybe it's military. I'm not sure. could be. Orndorff is the NWA World's Heavyweight Champion. I know that we've discussed this previously.
Municipal Auditorium in Columbus, Georgia. Thank you, Sweet Lou.
Fantastic, fantastic on the spot. They're coming up with that information for us. Orndorff is the NWA champion. I don't think this was one of his better matches.
National. I think you meant national heavyweight champion.
No, I was going to say, what if he was the NWA World's Heavyweight
Champion? Oh, okay. Yes, and I'll talk about that too. Go ahead.
Yeah, because I kind of feel he certainly had the look. When he was really on, he had the mechanics down. I think the weak spot is his interviews, where he didn't get a voice until later on in his career. And even then, I don't think he was great, but certainly as a heel in the WWF, he was certainly better. I don't think this is a great showcase of what he was capable of. Or maybe I'm remembering Orndorff a little more fondly than he should be remembered, because he's a little sloppier in this match. But I do feel he could have been a very good transition champion. And what a great way to truly make a bigger star out of him. You know, similar to what they had done with Tommy Rich a year or two earlier. And I don't know if it really helped Rich at the end of the day, but I think giving Orndorff, maybe the Kerry Von Erich, maybe that's a closer alignment, giving him the title. Maybe it's a month, maybe it's 2 months, but something to give him the push, because I think it really could have helped him. So, Jeff, what do you think about that?
When I remember Paul Orndorff back in this period, and first of all, this was when Georgia was still just, oh my God, they had so much talent in that promotion. Yeah. You know, can't miss television. 6:05 on Saturdays, you know, these four guys, and it just seemed like every week somebody new came in. And then, you know, I was trying to think one of the questions, and I'll answer your Paul Orndorff question in a second. But when do you think, at what point do you, and I'm going to say something that is going to completely infuriate people on the board. When do you think the slide really started in Georgia?
And I like him a lot. I actually think he's one of the great guys out there. I think when Larry Zbyszko became national heavyweight champion with Killer Tim Brooks, for whatever reason, that promotion really seemed to go through a lot of changes.
I will say, I think, and I understand there were financial situations going on in the front office that have been alleged involving Jim Barnett and Ole Anderson. And then not just problems personally, but financial situations that may have been going on. They brought in Arn Anderson and Matt Bourne to be the lead heel tag team.
Yes.
Matt Bourne had legal issues, so they had to, you know, hit the crapper on that one. And they brought in the Road Warriors, okay? They brought in the Road Warriors, and they wanted to get them over as this dominant heel team. So they started literally squashing everybody. And, you know, they were super over. I get that. But then at some point, you know, I always say wrestling, you know, at this time period, I know it's changed over the years, but it was always a battle of good versus evil. But eventually, good had to win. And the problem was, they got so over, and quite frankly, I think they got so full of themselves, then they got the Japan deal, that they decided they didn't want to lose, ever. And how can you push somebody that never wants to lose? You know, it's very difficult. You can use them as a like an Andre or an Abdullah the Butcher. But when you had a team that was the staple of your promotion, because you would push them that way, and they never wanted to lose or never were willing to lose, what do you do? You've painted yourself into a corner, and that's what Ole did. He got this team over huge. The guys were working real hard. I don't think they were the greatest team ever. I'm sorry, but they were certainly.
Well, they weren't. They weren't the greatest team.
Because they were new, but they became a solid team. They were, you know, did good work in the ring, but they created this monster that they didn't know what to do with after they create, you know, after they created. And unfortunately, because of the way the wrestling world had begun to change, if this had happened in the, say, even the late 70s, what they could do is they could farm them out to different territories like they did with Andre and guys like Abdullah. And they would have remained a huge deal every time they came into town, say once every, I don't know, 3 or 4 months. They would have been a main event attraction. You didn't have to worry about them doing a job because who cares? But when you're there week after week, I'm sorry, that's when the promotion started going downhill. That's when guys like you mentioned Zbyszko and Pez Watley and guys like that came in, were made main eventers. No offense to Pez Watley, who was a fine mid-card guy, but I never saw as a main event talent. Okay.
And not in Georgia either. I mean, he made it back in Nashville.
Not in Nashville. But anyway, this isn't a rant necessarily on the Road Warriors. It's a rant on collateral problems that happened within the front office led to those kind of situations and the Matt Bourne situation. And so that's when the promotion started, in my mind, going downhill. However, at this point, hold on 1 second, Bear. Swig of Fiji water for the working man.
Very nice. For the working man. You guys drinking water all the way from Fiji, the working man. God bless you. Well, yes.
Looking for an end. Fiji, Barry, come on.
Nice. And so, for the working man, right. The closest we're ever going to get to Fiji. That's for sure.
Wait a minute. This is a sponsor. Wait a minute. Swig of water for Ian Totten. How about that?
There you go.
There we go. I proudly support Ian Totten and my Fiji water. But at this point, the promotion was still really hot. You had all this talent going into the promotion. Okay. And these four guys were all super over, super talented, Superstar and Super D were a great tag team. Just think about the way the wrestling world has changed. The Observer move of the year, I believe that year, was Super D's suplex off the top rope. I mean, think about a move that now is barely a transition move. That was his killer finisher, Barry.
Sure. Well, it was fantastic. Orton Jr. also did it for years and they were the first. And, I remember the first time I saw, I believe it was in Japan. It was one of the women giving a pile driver from either the middle rope or the top rope and just going, wow, what's going to happen next? But yeah, things have changed a lot. So that's a really good point about the Road Warriors when you stop. And this is not a crap on the, because for a lot of people, that's when they grew up. You grew up watching the Road Warriors and they were certainly impressive. And I think in the short term, Jeff, until it became too redundant 6 months or a year later, whatever it was. But certainly the first few months, it was really impressive, though, because it was something new. It was original. We are seeing two guys who look like a couple of monsters come out, win their matches in 90 seconds because nobody else was doing it. You know, at some point, everybody started copying and these squashes that went on for 90 seconds became super redundant. But in the beginning, we didn't always see that. So it was kind of original. Unfortunately, seeing the same shtick years later completely took it away. But if you're saying, I think the best, in my opinion, again, which means absolutely nothing, if you're saying the Road Warriors are your favorite tag team of all time, big thumbs up. If you're saying they're the greatest tag team of all time and you've seen other people, other tag teams via YouTube, I don't see how you can logically say that. Because they weren't. They weren't even close to it.
And, you know, and I think part of the problem, and this was absolutely not their fault, was they did not have a really strong babyface tag team that could, you know, that they could go ahead. You dominate the Mulkeys on TV. That's no problem. But then when you go to the arenas, you got to have a babyface tag team that you give some offense to make it a competitive match. And that was part of the problem. They didn't have competitive teams to have, you know, against them. And that was not their fault. That was the, you know, problem of the front office. Okay. So I'm certainly not putting all the blame on them for the way they got over, but I think that's part of what led to the redundancy. Now, let me finally get to the friggin' Paul Orndorff question. We beat around the bush.
Okay. But one more thing when you say that too. So I saw the Road Warriors, I want to say it was 83, and it was the first time I'd ever seen them in person. And they came to Miami Beach and they wrestled Buzz and Brett Sawyer, Buzz now a babyface, teaming with his younger, much less talented brother.
And a smaller brother.
and just he's a real piece of work as well. I've had some dealings with him that I could probably talk about at some point. But the Road Warriors actually did the job that night at the convention center. So you've got Brett Sawyer, 5'8", give or take, and the Road Warriors are doing a job for the Sawyer brothers on Miami Beach, which makes absolutely no sense whatsoever.
No, not at all. And that's just an example of, you know, a team that they're facing. You know, Buzz Sawyer, because Buzz Sawyer had such fire.
Yes.
You know, but if you give Buzz Sawyer a somebody who has a little bit of size that was believable, it would have made for interesting tag team series. But the promotion didn't feed them that tag team they needed. Okay, Paul Orndorff. Yes, Paul Orndorff, absolutely. I think would have made a fine transition champion, like you said, for 3 or 4 months. He had tons of fire. I really liked him a lot as a babyface. I loved him as a heel. I can remember after going to a match in West Palm Beach between Flair as champion versus Butch Reed, and Flair narrowly escaping with the title, thinking to myself, there's no way this guy's going to get past Paul Orndorff. Paul Orndorff is going to kill Ric Flair. I mean, you know, that was me as one of those clueless marks, if you will, Barry, to quote you know who. But anyway, I just thought Paul Orndorff was so believable. He would have made you're right. He wouldn't have made a good long-term champion, but short-term, coming out of the national spotlight in Atlanta, I think not that everybody had to be, you know, coming out of Atlanta, but, you know, had proven himself on a national spotlight, gotten himself over. I think he would have made a fine transitional champion, would have offered a new really worthy challenger to whether it was Race, Flair, whoever. And I think a guy that very easily could have slipped into a heel, you know, slash babyface Dory Funk Jr., that sort of champion that could work either way, you know, whether it's subtle heel or a full out heel. Or you know, kick-ass babyface. I think he would have worked in both roles. So yeah, this match goes 15, 16 minutes.
Yep.
Again, it's probably not as good a Southern tag team match as last week's Rock and Roll versus Heavenly Bodies. I will admit to that. But if you want to talk about matches from Georgia, there's not a lot of them out there. Even though there was all that talent there, they were erasing tapes and stuff like that. So, and there's not a lot of great arena stuff, and most of the arena stuff is maybe, you know, a 2 or 3 minute clip. You don't get to see a full match very often. But Tommy Rich, like I said, he had started the downward slide a little bit there. I don't know if he had started the feud with Buzz Sawyer by this point or not, but he was still, I mean, when he comes in for the babyface comeback, the crowd pops huge because he's still hugely, hugely over with that Georgia crowd.
Let's talk about that for a minute too, Jack. Okay. Tommy Rich, and it's one of my notes, which is amazing that you said it. Tommy Rich's strong point is his comebacks.
Yeah.
Because when he gets the hot tag and he gets in there, hey, the building goes nuts, but Rich, that's when Rich really performs. His strong point was not, you know, in the middle of a match, whether it's a headlock or an arm drag or something like that. That's not it. It's the comeback for Tommy Rich when he gets, as he used to say, fired up.
I hear someone say something about fine up.
That's it.
So, this is a match I would recommend, if nothing else, to look at how good Paul Orndorff was at that point. Tommy Rich's fire and... Once again, the tag team of Super D and Mass Superstar. Oh, we didn't really talk about Bill Eady. Fucking Bill Eady was tremendous at this point. He was already a main eventer in New Japan, I believe. And, you know, just a super, super talent. He is one of the, you know, you talk about your great masked men of all time, you know, whether it's Sport
Jeff,
or Don. Or,
Jeff, yes. this is an amazing. So you and I are literally at this point morphing into one human being.
Well, don't shit yourself, Barry.
Well, we both are. So my other notes are, I've got 4 other notes. One, the botched finish. The finish is completely botched. And I think a lot of that has to go on Orndorff, who seems out of it. But my other two were Super D and Superstar in their legacy of wrestling. And the next one, greatest masked wrestlers of all time, Jeff.
That's kind of eerie.
Yeah, it is eerie, isn't it? That's a little.
Sort of, it's sort of eerie, like Ian Totten's new book, Throwaway Girls of Illinois. Yeah, how you like that one?
What a great segue, Jeff.
That's pretty good. I hear I'm pretty good at that. So anyway, but what I was saying about Bill Eady, to me, had about a 5-year run where he might have been, not to offend the Don Jardine fans out there, he might have been the best mask guy of all time. I mean, he was tremendous.
Are you waiting for me?
Yeah, I'm waiting for you.
I couldn't
that
tell.
That was not right. A segue.
Yes, exactly. I couldn't tell right there. Bill Eady's run in professional wrestling, going back to when he was one of the Mongols, it's an absolutely incredible career he had. And the fact that he was still relevant under so many gimmicks so many years later. And supposedly, I met him once. I take that back, and it was brief. super nice guy. And it's a guy that I actually want to get to one of the CWF fan fests. And if we do one later this year, you probably might actually be seeing Bill Eady on there. But yeah, I would agree. So if I was looking at my favorite masked wrestlers of all time, I'm going to say the two that stand out the most for me, the spoiler that you just mentioned. I was lucky I saw the spoiler in his heyday, and the guy was unbelievable. And the other being the assassin, which is the original assassin, Jody Hamilton. And there were so many great masked wrestlers, but to me, those two were a step above. If you go to that next level, I guess right below the assassin and the spoiler, I would put the Super Destroyer and the Masked Superstar right there.
Yeah, of course, Super Destroyer, a huge run in Florida with Mr. Florida and the Paul Jones angle, just tremendous. I was really kind of disappointed when he took off the hood. You know, I mean, I realized at some point the whole mask gimmick had started kind of running its course, and guys wearing masks were being phased out. I actually had a chance at one of the dinners to sit with Bill Eady, super nice guy, and I always remember one of Gordon Solie's lines about the mask: college educated. And he just very nice. And, you know, the thing, it kind of in a strange way disappoints me is so many people grew up with Bill Eady as part of Demolition. And Demolition, they were a good, solid tag team. They weren't as good as Masked Superstar and Super D. I'm sorry. But I, as much as I thought they were a good team, Bill Eady was so much better as the Masked Superstar because he was that silent killer, you know, and just so in a way, very similar to Jody Hamilton as the Masked Assassin. I had forgot about him. That's a very good point. And Don Jardine is a spoiler. So, we'll post this match. It's a very, you know, good, solid match with four tremendous talents, each different in their own way. But that Superstar, Super D gimmick. When I was looking for a match and I saw that tag team, I said, wow, this is a tag team that's just been forgotten to time. And really, people need to get a chance to look at their work because they're really good. Okay, Barry, now it's time, if we haven't done so already, to really get the blood boiling on the group. Your favorite segment, the top 1000 classic rock songs, Barry. Are you ready to go?
Oh, I'm not. But I do have some notes here that I wanted to read. Benji Fido reached out to me this week. I've got three different quotes that I want to share about this. Benji Fido, wow, a lot of anger with that top 1000 list. I completely understand.
Wait till we get to the top 50.
A lot of these songs mentioned are played on classic rock radio, and a lot are being eased out in favor of some stuff from 92 to 98. That stuff is becoming the new classic rock. However, to have some of these great artists like Pat Benatar, The Clash, landing where they do is atrocious. I think whoever put the list together thought it's okay to have 1,000 songs. We can't put crap at the beginning. We will lose people. So throw in some stuff people know that grabs them, and then put in deep tracks, which they did, and plug the channels where they can hear this stuff regularly. I know the list is meant to invoke something from people. Well, it has invoked something. In the end, it's a piece of corn shit where you, which I love, where you may see a good kernel. Oh my God. It's like the shit episode again.
I don't think Benji has gotten this harsh on anything
ever. Where you may see a good kernel that makes you go, wow. Other than it sucks.
I forgot to warn Antonio about his father's language there.
I am, however, grateful it wasn't the top 1,000 new wave songs because you may have had a stroke. Yes, that's guaranteed. Pat Benatar checking in. Fuck whomever put my songs in the 900s on this stupid fucking list.
You know what I forgot to mention? Let me just Pat Benatar. Sure. I'm not sure if I got the verbiage right. Operatically trained musician. Yeah. She was trained to sing opera. Because she had such a range in her voice, which is absolutely incredible, by the way. Okay, go ahead.
I read her biography years ago, and she was trained. And then I believe her first husband, his last name was Benatar. I think he was in the military. They wound up getting divorced, and she kept the Benatar name because her career had kind of taken off at that point. But that's what I remember from that. But she seems like a decent person.
And let's not forget, Barry, yes. Three, not one, not two. Three girls at Ridgemont High all adopted the Pat Benatar.
Yes, and that was a great look if you remember that too.
Yes.
Ron Gardner checking in, just wrapped up another good episode, Jeffrey and Barry. That damn classic rock list is the biggest clusterfuck I may have ever seen. I took a look at the entire list and can't wait to hear your takes on the next round. I can honestly say after looking quickly, there are at least 200 to 300 that do not even belong.
Well, and you know, that's a fair comment, because I really think when you're coming up with 1,000 songs, you know, at some point you're just throwing shit against the wall. You know, I mean, like, yep. Make it a little more, you know, even 250, where you can have some really, really good songs on there without putting deep tracks that no one ever hears anywhere on the radio. You might be a fan. I mean, there's songs I know that I've never heard on the radio that I'm a huge fan. I'll give you an example. And this isn't a classic rock song. I'll just give you an example. I love Billy Joel's song, Rosalinda's Eyes. It's off the 52nd Street album. Okay. It's a great song that you never hear on the radio. So guess what? If they're doing, you know, top 1000 70s pop songs, if Rosalinda's Eyes aren't on there, I can't complain about that. It's a song that personally I, you know, it hit on with me. So, but you know, don't sit there and say that's the number 10 song of the decade, because it's not. It's ridiculous. So some of the deep tracks on there might appeal to one or two, as I said before, music snobs who are into classic rock. But, you know, the rest of the audience is like, what the fuck song is that? I've never heard of that. And that was part of my problem with the list. Barry, let's start with number 700. Play along with us, if you will, at home. Okay, I'm going to ask you, Barry, what the following song, do you have your list in front of you here, Barry?
I do.
Okay, so you're going to cheat on this. Barry, tell me what the following songs have in common. Alice Cooper, No More Mr. Nice Guy, Santana, Winning, which, by the way, I kind of like that song, about 1980-81, Foreigner, Urgent, Talking Heads, by the way, David Byrne, the other night on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
How great was that? Awesome. Once in a Lifetime, which is a fantastic song. Lynyrd Skynyrd, Simple Man. Loggins and Messina, Your Mama Don't Dance, Papa Don't Rock and Roll. Again, whether that's classic rock, not really sure about that. What do all those songs have in common, Bear?
They're all 694 to 700 on this stupid.
And they're also not as good as Cat Stevens' Wild World. Are you,
there you
fucking
go.
Kidding me?
So here's a couple of things I'll pull up right here, too. Santana Winning at 699. I'll pull it up, pull it out. I'll do whatever I got to do with this one. Winning is a nice song. It's a nice song, Jeff.
Yeah, no,
it doesn't deserve to be on the top 1,000.
Absolutely correct. It's again, a song that appealed to me. Is it one of the greatest 1,000 rock songs? No, not at all.
It's a wimpy song, too, but it's a nice song, but it's a little wimpy. Talking Heads' Once in a Lifetime was a game changer, and I'm going to tell you why, because even though that wasn't the first big Talking Heads song, that was the first song that turned them on to mainstream America. Yeah. And they had Psycho Killer. They had had some other songs. Those were a little more underground. This is the song that was getting MTV airplay. It was a big deal. Completely changed everything. Lynyrd Skynyrd, Simple Man, 696. This is my favorite Lynyrd Skynyrd song by far. It's not even close. This is number one and everything else is number two. To put this down at 696 is, look, you want proof that this list is full of shit. Your Mama Don't Dance by Loggins and Messina at 694 is the exclamation point.
They are artists, Barry.
Yeah. Your Mama Don't Dance. Give me a fucking break.
It's funny because I don't know if it was Eric Chilminski that just, you know, who posts his comments on certain albums.
Yeah.
It was him or I read it somewhere else. Just posted something about the song Simple Man and how they came to write the song, which is really interesting about how Ronnie Van Zant had sat and had a conversation, I think, with his grandmother and if not his mom, then somebody else's mom. And even though he wasn't the only son, he wrote into the song, you know, sit down beside me, my only son. He was one of three sons. But how he came to write the song was really a pretty interesting story. OK, let's keep going with this shit list here. Beatles, 688, Back in the USSR. Really? There are 687 songs better than that. Let's see.
680. Paul McCartney, Listen to What the Man Said. Really? How do I even justify Paul McCartney's legacy of great songs, which he has? And I'm not the biggest Beatles McCartney guy.
Yeah, and right in front of this, by the way, Rick Derringer, Rock and Roll Hoochie Coo. Give me a fucking break.
Yeah.
However, I'm a little upset that your personal theme song, which is, of course, The Stones, Midnight Rambler, and then 682. That's a disservice to you, Barry.
100%. Look, I'm going to tell you right now, 673, The Wind Cries Mary, Jimi Hendrix. Yes, not as good.
Right behind as John Mellencamp, Crumbling Down.
Oh, or Jimmy Buffett, Margaritaville. Let me go on. I fucking hate Jimmy Buffett. I do. Jimmy Buffett, here's what bothers me. Jimmy Buffett is me. He's a guy that likes to be in the Keys. He likes to be on the water, at the beach. He's all about saving the manatees. He's a big basketball fan. He's a great father. He's just a shitty fucking musician. I can't stand Jimmy Buffett's music. I like him. Margaritaville. Oh my God. But here's the crazy thing. So you've got Margaritaville at 667. The Who's, I can't explain. Oh, is just one number better? Really?
It's just so much disappointment here, Barry. I can't even believe it. Let's see.
None of this makes any sense whatsoever.
Well, and I will say, I don't know if this is confession time. I actually went and saw Jimmy Buffett in concert. I enjoyed myself. Okay.
People love his concerts.
Huge party and stuff like that. But again, is Jimmy Buffett really classic rock? I mean, do you turn on classic rock rewind and say, give me some fucking Buffett, man?
Is he rock at all? Is he rock at all, Jeff? Is it? No, again, people go to his concerts and that's what, you know, they're parrot heads and they come back and say that was the greatest night of my life. And I believe them. It's like they're having a great time. Yeah. Musically, I think the guy totally fucking sucks. But that's me.
662 Bowie, China Girl.
Great song. Yeah. Should be in the top. I'll go top 500, if not higher. But, you know, no.
So right behind that. Marrakesh Express by Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Now, let me ask you.
That's a nice song.
Yeah, I like Crosby, Stills, and Nash, some of their songs, but is it really, and I know they were there for Woodstock and all that kind of stuff, Sweet Judy, Blue Eyes, we haven't got to that yet. Are they really a classic rock group, though? Or are they more folk rock?
Some people are going to say they're classic rock. I'm going to agree with you.
No, and I don't necessarily. It's
a little soft though, especially this song, Marrakesh Express. It's a very, I see Crosby, Stills, and Nash playing Marrakesh Express in the park, smoking a bunch of joints on acoustic guitars. You know what I mean? That's what I see. That doesn't strike me as classic rock.
I will say, and in a non-paid plug, David Crosby's book, Long Time Gone, which came out, good Lord, 15, 20 years ago, is a really good book about a guy in the music industry and just the incredible roller coaster his career took when this guy got into coke and got thrown into really badass prison in Texas and his redemption after that. It's an incredible story. And it's a book. You know, we talked before about great books involving the music industry. Long Time Gone by David Crosby is a really good book. I really enjoyed it.
Have you seen the movie about him? It's a documentary. I haven't seen it, but I hear it's fantastic.
Yeah, no, I have not seen it. You know where it's available. Let me know and I'll have to check it out. Okay, let's see. We got Deep Purple, 660 Woman from Tokyo, and 659 Steve Miller Band, Jungle Love.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of wonderful Grand Funk Railroad. I would have, I like the song. It's a remake, of course, of a Motown song. I would have put it maybe in the 900s. That's my only complaint. I don't think it should be that high. Pat Benatar, there she is again.
And she's pissed.
She's getting fucked by this list. No one's saying thank you, Pat. You know, she's not getting any kind of gratitude. Here again, our old for 650, John Mellencamp, Lonely Old Night, which is only one song below You Are My Best Friend by Queen. Right. Yeah. John is some of his song. I got to say,
you don't like him. You don't like, I can. I
no, no. There are songs by John Mellencamp that I like. I like his really early stuff, which apparently he completely fucking hates. His early shit when he was just John Cougar.
Oh, I love that.
Like Ain't Even Done With the Night. I fucking love that song.
Yeah.
And his songs like, what was it? Not Scarecrow, but maybe the album right after that. I like that. Those two albums. And then the stuff after that is complete dog shit. But, you know, everyone likes that, you know, what is it, the Jack and Diane? Oh, my God. That song was so fucking overplayed.
You ever watch the TV show Blackish?
No.
I
know
it.
What you're talking about. Anthony Anderson's in it, right?
Yeah, yeah. I know we've talked about this before because you're a fan of Anthony Anderson. It's a great show, and it's really grown on me over the last couple of months. But he has twin children. They're young, and their names are Jack and Diane.
That's funny. That's funny. Let's see. Okay, how about this one, Barry? 641 America, 10 Man. How is America on a classic rock list? Let's be honest, folks.
Yeah, that's going back. So I saw America in concert, I think 1982 at the Sunrise Musical Theater. And I got to say, for what it was very good because it's essentially two guys on guitars just harmonizing. But again, if I think of rock and roll, and I realize, look, it's similar to New Wave. There's so many different versions of rock and roll, but I don't see this as, you know, like 642. Is feel like so America Tin Man is ranked one higher than Bad Company's Feel Like Making Love, which to me is a classic rock song.
Yes. And right in front of Talking Heads, or I should say, but Tin Man is squeezed between Feel Like Making Love and Talking Heads Love During Wartime.
Oh,
yeah. Like what the fuck, people? Really? Wait a minute. Hold on, Barry. Listen. Do you hear it? Do you hear that?
What was that?
It's the people in our group sitting there going, what the fuck is wrong with this list?
Yeah. Like, well, they're right. God damn it. They're absolutely right. And just to say, too, you brought up David Byrne. He was doing this this show on Broadway, and I believe he is returning in the fall. So I've heard from everybody that's seen it that it's one of the great shows in the history of life that make your way to go up there and see it. And that's actually an unpaid plug. But Jeff, as we were doing Ian Totten's book, did we give a plug as to where they can purchase this book?
I don't believe we did.
Well, we're going to post this link in our Facebook group if you're not a member, or you can reach out to us privately, Jeff or myself, but we will provide all the details of where you can purchase Ian Totten's latest work. However, we have no connection with David Byrne's Broadway show if you're looking for tickets.
However, if David would like to be sponsored, and you know, we can certainly request that he follow us here on BowdrinPod.com. So anyway, on with the. By the way, I did not know, as I went and on the old YouTube there and found the David Byrne appearance on Saturday Night Live, which once again, as I said, if you haven't seen it, it's just, oh my God. Even if you're just sort of a David Byrne fan, it's really fantastic. I did not know, Barry, that he is autistic.
I didn't know that either. That
makes there's a whole link. Yeah. There's a whole link with him doing a Q&A with somebody where he talks about his autism and stuff like that, which I thought was pretty fascinating, actually. So when we got, 6:35, Jackson Browne, The Loadout, which I think is a great song,
yeah.
Followed by Stay, which is sort of a pop song from the, who did it? It was
Maurice Chevalier.
No, it was not Maurice Chevalier. Maurice and the Zodiacs or something like that did it originally in the 60s, like a Motown song. And I'm going to get hell from somebody in the group. I can't fucking believe you didn't remember it was when. I'm sure Lou will tell me who it was. And right in front of that, we got Petty, Don't Come Around Here No More. Behind Victim of Love by the Eagles, which is one of the all-time, and I know, Barry, you're not a huge Eagles fan, one of the all-time shittiest Eagles songs, Victim of Love in front of Petty. Oh, my God, that is a...
So you think I don't like the Eagles? That's based off of Lebowski. That's why you think I don't. It's so ingrained in your mind that when you think of me,
Maurice Williams and the Zodiacs. I knew I got part of that fucking answer right. So yeah. Thank you, I appreciate it. Let's see. And right in front of Victim of Fucking Love, Moody Blues. I'm Just a Singer in a Rock and Roll Band. Then Heart, 6:31, Straight On. Okay, here's one, 6:29.
I knew you were going to go there. You were going to go there.
Why?
I'm looking at this list going, how the fuck could this song make a top 1,000? And I like this song, but yes.
It's Ace How Long, which has a great vocal, I believe, by Paul Carrack, who is a great, great rock vocalist. But yeah, it probably doesn't belong here. By the way, Rod Stewart on, I got to remember the album title now. It's the one... I know every fucking Rod Stewart album. I'm gonna think of it in a second. He does a cover version of How Long that's a really, really strong. Rod Stewart does a lot of really good covers. He does some that quite frankly fall flat, but
So let me ask you a question. So I would be curious to know how many people voted on this list. I just looked at 616. And if you, and I like the song, but if you mean to tell me that this song is above all the other songs on this list, at 616 of the 1,000 greatest classic rock songs of all time, this is all you need to know. The Outfield in Your Love.
So what I did was
As
I was going through and I looked at this list, I noticed that The Outfield at 616 is three spots ahead of the Allman Brothers' Whipping Post. Wow. Are you fucking kidding me?
John Fogerty, center field, is 622.
Just unbelievable. What the fuck? You know, you've said it before, Barry, about
it's embarrassing. This is
15, 20 guys in Rolling Stone magazine's offices drinking some lattes and going, but we fucking throw this one in here, you know? It's just,
But at 616, The Outfield with Your Love. Again, nice song. And that's not the knock on it. But so there are multiple people voting for this song. So you've got, let's say there are 20 judges. How many judges had to vote to get The Outfield's Your Love? If I said to you, Jeff, give me 1,000 rock songs, would The Outfield Your Love be anywhere near that 1,000?
I don't think The Outfield would even have a song on there. And then there was another good mid-80s pop rock band.
Yes, but that's it.
You know, yeah, they're not exactly The Clash, you know. So the album I was thinking of from Rod Stewart, by the way, Tonight I'm Yours, early 80s. I thought it was a really good Rod Stewart album. So let's skip ahead a little bit. 613, we've talked about it many times. The Cars, moving in stereo from one of our all-time favorite movies. Harold Strasser will be happy because we mentioned the fucking Cars.
Yeah, that's Harold wearing his Cars t-shirt.
Undoubtedly, with the shirt tucked in. But
exactly.
I'm going to say anything about that.
I love that.
Let's see. Okay, 606, Barry. Are you with me?
I am.
There are 605 classic rock songs that are better than Van Halen's Jump.
Oh, yeah. Well, sure. Jane by Jefferson Starship at 602.
And that's not a bad song. No, like a 1,000, maybe like 990. But it shouldn't be
that. I don't even see that. It's in the top 2,000.
Jane in front of, by the way, Lynyrd Skynyrd's Gimme Three Steps.
Yeah, sure.
And my God.
Blue Collar Man by Styx, even, which is really one of the harder rocking more Styx songs with Tommy Shaw.
Yeah. Yeah, my wife, not a fan of the Dennis DeYoung stuff. She loves her some Tommy Shaw. That has been well expressed here on this. So here, how about 592? Emotional Rescue by the Stones. Let me just say, when that album first came out with that song and Mick sort of sang in a falsetto, I remember thinking, what the fuck is this guy doing? You know, like singing in falsetto, you know, and it's just, if they're going to include, you know, songs by the Stones that were, you know, big hits, throw this down in the mid 900s. This doesn't belong up here, especially right behind David Bowie's Rebel Rebel.
So I like this one, Jeff. At 596, the Eagles' New Kid in Town. Because when I think of rock and roll, that is rocking a song. But however,
right in front of Sweet Child of Mine,
it beats out Sweet Child of Mine. And then it's only one number below what is a really good rock song at 595, Cheap Trick's Dream Police.
Oh, and then we got, because I just heard this on the radio, they did 587, The Black Crowes, She Talks to Angels. Now, these guys were like the American version of Oasis, where the brothers went through a period where they completely fucking hated one another. They had like one or two albums that had some really good. They were compared very favorably to the Stones when they first broke out. She Talks to Angels, the good song. Yeah, probably in the right era, maybe a little bit higher, maybe like low 500s, you know. But Rod Stewart, You Wear It Well. That is one of my favorite Rod Stewart songs from his very early stuff when he was still Rod the Mod before he became, you know, into disco and. He was nailing Britt Eklund and kind of sort of went to hell there for a few years.
She was hot though, wasn't she?
She was. Yeah. And she was the voice at the end of Tonight's the Night. Ooh, Rod. Ooh. I can't do the Britt Eklund accent, but where she's basically saying in French, come fuck me, you know, or some such nonsense like that. So here again, that song, which I think is a really good song, The Beatles, Don't Let Me Down, AC/DC, Shot Down in Flames. Now here's I love fucking AC/DC. Okay.
Yep.
But how many times have you turned on the radio and said, oh, they're playing AC/DC's Shot Down in Flames? I'm sure this is somewhere on a deep tracks of one of their albums. I don't even know which one it's on. And somebody out there is going, oh, fucking Shot Down in Flames, man. That's like the ultimate AC/DC song that no one's ever fucking heard but you. How is this song above, like, you know, good songs like that? Okay, let me just, I got a good story. I don't know if I've ever told this story here. Now I'm going to tell a Barry Rose-esque restaurant story.
Is there shit involved or no?
It does not involve shit, but involves a very uncomfortable situation involving my family members and I. So 589, Bob Seger, huge Bob Seger fan. Fire Down Below. Have I ever told the story about the night we went to the blues club in somewhere where it was in South Carolina? It was in Charleston or maybe Myrtle. It was in the wife yelling out, it's in Charleston. So I'm there with my brother and his wife, my sister and her husband at the time, and Kim and I were there. And so my sister's, you know, we'd had dinner with my parents. They're going up to the hotel room. Let's go out and listen to some live music. So we go to the hotel front desk. Is there any good, like, blues or jazz bars? Oh, there's a place right across the street. They play live blues. Okay, that's good. So you go in, pay the cover charge, and there's, like, three people there. And we give the woman behind the desk, oh, here's our what do you call it? Cover fee? $5, maybe something like that. We go sit down. The chairs all have holes in them. It's a true fucking dive. Okay. So we're sitting there and a couple of guys come up on stage, start tuning the guitars and, you know, they start, you know, doing a little jam. And so we're going, okay, what's going on here? And about another 10 minutes goes by. Ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to introduce the star of the show tonight, singing for your listening pleasure. It's Big Mama. Okay. So guess who comes up on stage, Barry? Yes, it's the lady that was at the ticket window taking our ticket.
Ah.
His name apparently is Big Mama. So Big Mama comes on the stage and she starts singing. So eventually she gets to the Bob Seger song. She's doing a cover of Fire Down Below. Okay. And while she's doing it, she's let's just say, and then, by the way, mid-40s, late-40s, she's not a, Kim says higher, maybe mid-50s. She's not a gilf. She's not, certainly not a milf. And, you know, she's, you know, not looking strong. Let's put it this way. And so she's doing it. She's doing lots of gyrations that someone, quite frankly, her age probably should not be doing. If you're Mick Jagger, that's one thing. But if you're a mid-50s kind of fat broad, I'm going to get the fan mail from the mid-50s fat broads now. But she's like, you know, I got the fire down below. And she's like pointing right to the ovajayjay, okay? And so she's saying this. And we're all mildly uncomfortable about the fact that this woman is pointing at her pussy, you know, talking about how she's got a fire down below. Okay, just when we thought that was as uncomfortable as it could get, the song's over. Oh, Jim, I'd like to introduce my band here for you. And so Big Mama says, over here on the lead guitar, this is my husband, Bob. I'm going, oh, okay, yeah, your wife's talking about the fire down below. There's her husband, Bob. Over here on the left on bass, is my son, Joey. This poor fucking guy has to sit there and listen and look at his mom pointing at her fucking pussy every night, talking about how she's got a fire down below. Barry, on an uncomfortable scale, 1 to 10, what do you think?
That's pretty uncomfortable right there. I would give you, that's a solid 8 on the uncomfortability, depending on who you're with, obviously. If it's me and you and there's a buzz going, we're probably loving it. Yeah. If I'm with close family members, right.
You're there with Zoe and Zach. Man, yeah. That'd be a little uncomfortable
that's
there.
Pretty uncomfortable right there. Yeah.
So she had the fire down below that night, at least. I can tell you that. So continuing on with our list here, let's see. Mountain 583, Mississippi Queen. Ah, a staple of rock radio. I got no problem with that being on the list, Barry. Then 582. Now, you talked about the first time you heard Talking Heads and they really became mainstream. To me, I think the first time on regular, not even classic rock, top 40 radio, I think.
Yes, maybe
like absolutely. On Casey Kasem was the first time I ever heard the Talking Heads with their song Burning Down the House. Is that fair?
Yes, it's actually, Jeff, you are 100% correct.
Ah, thank you.
Check that off. Yeah, Life During Wartime and in the other song that you mentioned, that was more the MTV generation. And that's where it was getting the airplay. As far as radio, Burning Down the House, that whole album just completely just fucking exploded. Those two albums right there completely. So, yes, I would agree with you on that one.
Okay. 579, Elton John, Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me. Now, let me ask you. Elton John has some stuff that I think is really, you know, good classic rock song. And of course, he's got the real mellow pop, you know, he covered Disney, The Lion King and stuff like that. I actually like, and this is a very rare case of me, I like the George Michael cover where Elton John comes in at the end. I think that's a better version. It was also recorded live. What do you think of the two different versions?
I don't give a shit. So.
Okay, well.
I'm trying to be
you
nice.
Too. Mr.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
like I'm sure some classic rock aficionado is going to George Michael. I fucking hate him. Meet George Michael in the bathroom, something like that. So, okay, 574, David Bowie, Golden Years.
Wow, what a great song, too.
Right behind your favorite REO Speedwagon, Keep On Loving You, Baby.
Yeah, right. And I'm not a big fan of that. No. But you know,
I know you're a big REO fan.
Yeah, David Bowie, Golden Years, too. I think that is, it's overplayed, but my God, that's a fantastic song. And the fact that REO Speedwagon is just one number better with Keep On Loving You, again, shows you everything that you wanna know about this list.
Well, the good news is that Bowie's Golden Years is also not as good as John Mellencamp's Pink Houses.
Exactly. Yeah,
Or Journey's Any Way You Want It. Now, here's an argument for the folks. Journey was always considered what they called corporate rock. The Journey, REO Speedwagon, Styx. What do you think of that? You think they were corporate rock guys?
I think in hindsight, I don't know if we realized at the time that we were being force-fed what is now known as corporate rock. Certainly in hindsight, you look and yeah, my God. And there's so much internal strife with these guys. Apparently there was a coup last week where two members.
Yes, I did read about that. Yeah.
It's always Neil Schon and his wife, and obviously Steve Perry, who apparently was a real fucking douchebag years ago when they were at the height. You know, but I would agree. I think that's fairly accurate.
Weren't the two guys that got shit canned? Weren't they like original members of the group? At least they'd been in there like 30 years.
I think one guy was at least an original member. I'm not sure of the other one, but they were trying to do a coup. And as it turns out, I guess I forget who owns the name. Maybe it is Neil Schon or Jonathan, what's his name? Jonathan Kane. Maybe he, I'm not sure who actually owns the name, but yeah, they forced these guys out of the group. Crazy. It's crazy shit. Cause these guys have all got to be mid 60s, right?
Yeah. Something like that. Okay. So now I got a real problem with this. My Frank Costanza mode here.
Sure.
566, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers Breakdown, which I think is a tremendous song.
Yeah.
And, okay. So here I'll do another one, Barry. Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Our House. Again, I don't think it's a classic rock song. It's a good song.
It's a very, very fine house. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's three stoner hippie guys, which I love, sitting in the park, getting high, singing folk songs.
Yeah. So Petty, Breakdown, Bob Seger, Still the Same, Benatar, Shadow of the Night, Van Halen, Running with the Devil. None of those ranked as high. Paul Simon, Kodachrome. What the bleeding fuck? I mean, come on.
It's
I'm getting more pissed than Benji as I go through this list now.
Yeah, it is. Look, and how about this is funny to me. I love the song. I like the artist a lot, even though I know a lot of people in our group don't. 556, Billy Idol, Eyes Without a Face. That's the 556 best rock song of all time.
That's better than Running with the Devil.
I love it. I love this song.
Yeah, it's a good, but that to me is not hardcore Billy Idol. You know, that's more like kind of pop rock Billy Idol.
Yeah, but I love it. You know what it is? It's less him. It's more Steve Stevens and that guitar shit in the middle that I just think is incredible. I love that.
You know, my favorite, we haven't even got to it. Maybe it's on there. Maybe it's not. I don't know. I like the video for Billy Idol's Rock the Cradle. That was always a very cutting edge video. And the girl that was dancing for that guy in the video.
White Wedding. Do you remember the White Wedding video?
Yeah.
Huge. That was
hardcore Billy Idol still. You know, he hadn't quite really become a pop star.
He was emerging. Well, he left Generation X.
Yeah, he still had the sneer going and all that kind of stuff. And
still kind of a smug, arrogant prick, which was good because that's exactly what it was. But then he became, and you know, I think his talent too, as he started to progress, he went from White Wedding and that kind of shit to these more poppy type of songs.
Yeah. So 559, right in front of the hard rockin' Kodachrome, something Barry's experienced by Robert Plant, A Big Log.
So I love this song. I got to say.
Very atmospheric, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Jazz guitarist, kind of a jazz blues influence.
It was Jeff Beck, wasn't it? Wasn't Jeff Beck the guitarist on that?
I'm not sure about that. But yeah, that's like one of my favorite Robert Plant solo songs. I remember because
I got to tell you, when that song came out, that's my favorite song. He's got the other song that was from that album as well. I'm in the Mood for a Melody. What's that? What's that one called?
It's called I'm in the Mood. Yeah.
And then, I'm in the Mood. There you go.
I think Summer. It was another album he did, Little by Little. That's a really good song. I remember he was doing a live studio appearance. It might have been down in South Florida on the Paul and Ron show. And he left because one of the guys kept calling him Bob.
Really?
Yeah, he called him Bob Plant. And the guy, and like, he got up and left. It was pretty funny. So, let me see what else we got here. 553, Faces, Stay With Me. That's a really good, to me, the Faces, you know, I talked before about how I thought that Huey Lewis and the News were like basically a bar band that made it, you know, national. The Faces to me are one of those groups that you would like to see like in a bar somewhere in their prime, because they're all sitting there getting shit faced drunk, singing, you know, blues and rock and stuff like that. That's a group I would have liked to have seen them like in front of like 100 people in a bar.
No, I agree with that too. And it's, I think what I like about Faces and this song too, you do get the feeling it's just a bunch of guys that are kind of jamming and having fun.
Yeah. And then, let's see. 552, Steve Miller's Swing Town is not only a really good song. Did you ever see the very limited series? Because it canceled after about maybe eight episodes on CBS called Swing Town. Did you ever see that?
I don't think I ever did.
Yeah, it was like set, I want to say, in the mid to late 70s. And it was all about this neighborhood where all the couples would go to these swingers parties. And you go in and you throw the keys into a big, you know, pile. And you go in, you reach around, you pick up a set of keys. And whoever, you know, if it's a guy that picked it, whoever keys they belong to, he would take the woman who like was maybe his neighbor from four houses down and they'd go home and fuck.
Jeff, let me ask you a question. How far are we going to go into this list? Where are we cutting off?
We're going to go as far as we need to, by God.
Because I'm looking at 531 and I don't want to upset somebody we just mentioned. But if this song is on the top 1000 rock songs of all time, I'm not sure I can continue the show today.
Okay, Bear, 550, a song that I believe is really misunderstood. Eric Clapton's Wonderful Tonight. Again, that's a very slow jam, to be considered classic rock. But have you ever heard the story about the writing of that song?
Does this have to do with the death of his son?
No, that was okay. The other one. Wonderful Tonight, right. I actually have somebody I used to work with that used this as their wedding song. And then I read, it could be incorrect on this, I'm sure someone will tell me I'm wrong. I read that he wrote this song as a diss to his wife. He wasn't saying, you look wonderful tonight. It was very, here's our favorite word, snarky. Yeah, you look wonderful tonight, you know? And he was saying it almost in a disrespectful tone, much like the Police song, Every Breath You Take. People used Every Breath You Take as a fucking wedding song, Barry. It's a stalker song. How did people not understand it? So my point is that Wonderful Tonight was really written sort of, I think, as a very sarcastic shot at his then wife. I don't know if he's still married to her or not, but, you know, he was basically maybe in a drunken stupor, something like that, was kind of giving his wife sort of a verbal backhand slap. You know, saying, yeah, you look great. You look great. So 549, staple of classic rock, Centerfold by Jay Giles, Barry. That's someone we haven't talked about. Barry, were you a fan of Jay Giles?
I like Jay Giles at the time, but Jay Giles is not somebody I would ever sit and listen to now. But certainly 35, 40 years ago, yes, I guess I enjoyed their songs.
Again, here's another example of a really good bar band that had this song in Freeze Frame and made it national. And then Peter Wolf decided he was fucking Mick Jagger and wanted to go solo. But they had a couple of really good songs for the time and then, you know, went back to being a bar band, I guess. 546, Stop Dragging My Heart Around by Stevie Nicks and Tom Petty, staple of classic rock radio, and right behind Steely Dan's My Old School. Again, when's the last time you heard My Old School by Steely? I hear Steely Dan songs on classic rock all the time. I can't for the life of me ever remember the last time I heard My Old School, Barry.
I'm not sure I've ever heard it in my entire life. So yes. Yeah.
541, Bowie's Young Americans.
I mean, that right there was almost a game changer in a lot of ways when that song came out. So I think at least from a historical standpoint, not my favorite Bowie song, probably not even in my top 10 or 15, but from a historical standpoint, I think of, his career at that stage. Yeah, that's pretty important.
Not as big a deal as You Give Love a Bad Name by your friend Bon Jovi, Bear.
Well, and at 540, one number right below Bon Jovi is the Rolling Stones with Shattered, which I love Shattered. And when that song came out, I couldn't play it enough because I thought it was so
Shattered,
cool.
Shattered.
Yeah. Good, all that pitter patter. Yeah.
Yeah. So we want to jump to 531, Barry, just for you. 531, The Cars.
Harold.
Shake it up.
Harold, so we can maintain our friendship, if you will just mute the podcast for the next
about 30 seconds.
30 seconds. Again, the Cars have so many good songs. To put Shake It Up, which was a mindless, brainless pop song, at best on this list, again, should tell you all you need to know about this. And again, I have this vision of 20 to 25 self-important pseudo-intellectual nerds sitting in a room drinking pumpkin spice lattes going, you know what? I want to put the car Shake It Up in the top 500 or 600. And the rest of these little morons going, yes, yes, absolutely.
Well, what's the name of that band again? Because they were popular before I was born. Yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
So 528, Steve Miller, Fly Like an Eagle. Again, staple of classic rock radio.
Yeah, Barry. It is. Like him or don't like him, it absolutely is.
Yeah, 526, Peter Gabriel, Sledgehammer, one of those innovative rock videos of all time, certainly. Yep. 525, nope, that's not it. 523, I'm sorry, The Who, one of my favorite Who songs, Can You See the Real Me?
And boy, does that deserve to be in the top 150 as opposed to 523.
That's a tremendous song.
But 525, which you just hit on and then glossed over, The Guess Who with These Eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, is it classic rock or is it soft, folky coffee house? It's the coffee house rock.
Yeah. Now, you turn on a classic rock station in your local market or on one of the SiriusXM classic rock channels, I can guarantee you in any 24-hour period, you are going to be hearing at 522, Grand Funk Railroads were an American band. This song, strictly from Airplay, Barry, belongs in the top 150.
Yeah, I'd agree. Jeff, I think we need to try to get somebody from SiriusXM to be on the show with us next week as we rip through this fucking list and see what kind of reaction, because I want to hear, and I don't want to hear somebody from our own group, because that's an opinion. I want to hear somebody who's involved with this list justify or give us some sort of explanation for some of the posturing and positioning of these songs. That's what I want to hear. I want to hear somebody involved with this.
Yeah, some of the stuff on here is 516, Elton John, Someone Saved My Life Tonight. That's a great song.
Sugar
514, Boy. The Clash, Train in Vain. Really? There are 513 songs better than that. Get the fuck out of here. let me see what else. Let's see. Bowie, 507, Let's Dance. That was like a real career trend. He changed his style of music. I think that was done by Nile Rodgers, that album. And it was a huge video on MTV. 506, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Here Comes My Girl. Tremendous song. Let's see. We're going to wrap it up here for this week. Trying to see if there's anything else that really pissed me off more than anything else. 518, let me jump back to Bruce Springsteen, Rosalita, Can You Come Out Tonight? Again, a song that, listening to a classic rock, they play that song every other fucking day. And I don't understand how you can have it this low. Whether you like Springsteen or not, I understand there's a lot of people that don't. But this guy's songs are on the radio all the fucking time. 503, underrated song, Barry. The Kinks, Come Dancing.
Yeah, that is. That's an underrated song. That was another great video, by the way, that they did. So, yeah, I like this song a lot. I don't know if I'm going to argue the position of the song.
No, it belongs on the list.
I like it a lot.
You know, but it's a very underrated song. So, okay, as we wrap up here, we'll go to 501. Again, classic rock or not. Billy Joel, My Life. Is that a classic rock song or more of a classic pop tune?
In my opinion, it's a classic pop tune. Yeah,
that's kind of what I was thinking too. And to close out, 500, Lynyrd Skynyrd, as my friend Kathy used to say at work, Lenny Skinny. And it is What's Your Name, which is a great rock song,
What's
by the way.
What's Your Name, Little
Pretty
Girl. Yeah.
So that belongs here. Maybe a little bit higher too. So, okay. So we're going to wrap up at 500 this week. That's 200 fucking songs we covered there, Barry. So before we begin our go home for the week, Barry, let's talk about a show that you and I are both into. I have wrapped up season one. You are close to the go home for Amazon Prime's show with Al Pacino called Hunters. How fucking great is this show?
Wow. So look, whenever this is what I was thinking too, as I was watching this show, there was a lot of negative reviews of this show, not from people on Facebook or social media, but people who are paid to write reviews. And I got to tell you, please, anytime somebody writes a review, always take it with a grain of salt. Sometimes you're going to agree, sometimes you're not. But there are a plethora of negative reviews.
I haven't used that word in a while, by the way.
I know, from professional reviewers out there slamming this show. Boy, do I disagree with that. I was hooked from the first episode. I am 8 episodes down with 2 left. You have completed it. I think this show is flawless. I think this to me is Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds in a lot of ways, but better. I love the setting of 1977 New York. The acting is great. The writing and the character development is great. I mean, essentially, the show is about a group of Nazi hunters led by Al Pacino in 1977. The show is also heartbreaking. There are several scenes that go back to the Auschwitz and concentration camps. And there, I don't want to spoil, but there's a scene with a mother and a father and a small child. And I was close to tears on that one because it was really, truly heartbreaking. I cannot recommend this show enough. And I'm thrilled, Jeff. I got to admit, I've slowed down tremendously the last few years. I don't go out as much as I used to. And television has taken over for movies, going to the movie theater for me. But between shows that we've seen, whether it's Righteous Gemstones, Better Call Saul, which is currently on, Barry, which I just fucking blew me away. But now we're on to Hunters, and I've only got 2 episodes left, and I'm savoring them and holding on to them, Jeff, because I don't know what I'm going to do with myself when those 2 episodes are over.
So you said you were into it after the first episode. I was into this show 10 minutes in, because the opening scene of the show is so shocking and so just what the F that it grips you right there by the throat and holds on to you for the rest of it. I was talking to Barry and Lou before we started recording. I said, this show is part history lesson, It is part Grindhouse Cinema. There is, I'm going to say fantasy. It's not fantasy like Lord of the Rings or something like that, but there is like these little satiric vignettes that are done in a very poke fun at a horrible situation where you kind of like, how can I say it, Barry? You laugh, but at the same time, you're realizing the situation is, you know, we talked about a particular thing that Barry saw in the eighth episode that's very offensive, but it's done so satirically that you can't sit there and go, oh, my God, I can't believe they did that and made it funny. Do you understand what I'm saying, Barry?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, exactly. Right.
But you're absolutely right. Some of the stuff where there's flashback segments to the Holocaust and being in the concentration camps at Auschwitz that are just, oh, my God, just so troubling and so heartbreaking. As people that are there, there are members of this particular group of about, I want to say 6, 7, maybe 8 people that have their own memories. And I'll give you another example. And this doesn't give away anything. There's a scene where the daughter of two of the people in the group is getting married. And throughout the whole series, this family who are the couple are Jewish and the guy's played by Saul Rubinek, who's a veteran character actor you'll recognize immediately. And Saul Rubinek, after the concentration camps, has gone away from his faith. He's gone away from the Judaism. He won't go to temple anymore. He will talk to the rabbi, but he refuses to go to services. And at the end of the service, after his daughter has been married, and there's a very touching scene where his daughter tells him, you can let go now, Daddy, as she's getting ready to go be married. But at the end of the scene, the rabbi is saying a prayer. Forgive me for not knowing what the prayer is called, Barry. And at the end of the prayer, Saul Rubinek's character says, amen. And his wife turns to him and said, that's the first time you've said amen in over 30 years. And, you know, you don't have to be Jewish to have it grab you by the heartstrings, Barry. It was just a very touching scene.
No, I think if anything, too, I think, and I want to avoid, but I think a lot of the portrayal of Jews in media at times can be very negative. And I think this show is extremely positive. At the same time, showing the horrors of what took place in the Holocaust. And I think, you know, I think everybody listening to this show is aware of the Holocaust and is aware to some degree of what took place. But I think at the same time, we remove ourselves from the emotional connection to it. And what I mean that is when you think about the fact in the scene, again, spoiler alert, maybe mute this for a minute. But the scene where a young Saul Rubinek and Carol Kane are separated from their child and their child is shot in front of them. And then her connection in the dream or whatever that in her mind years later where she gets to see her son.
Oh, yes.
I was close to tears, man. Yeah, I got to be honest.
And, you know, one of the things I told you before we started recording is you forget what a great actress Carol Kane is. Carol Kane was nominated for an Academy Award. I want to say it's for Hester or Hester Street, around 70, 78, something like that. And she's she was, of course, so tremendous. And God, why do I fucking forget all these movies?
Well, she was big on Taxi, too, remember?
Oh, yeah. She was hilarious. Yeah. Latka's girlfriend. Why the fuck am I drawing a blank on the movie? Have fun storming the castle, playing Billy Crystal's wife. God, Lou, you're going to have to talk
about the one.
The Princess Bride.
Why couldn't I fucking? But she was in that as Billy Crystal's wife. And she was hilarious in that, you know? And just a tremendous act. Saul Rubinek, I remember from Unforgiven. He was a journalist in Unforgiven. But a guy that's been in a zillion things. The lead heel is played by Lena Olin. Lena Olin is another one of those people you go, where the fuck have I seen her before? And she's been in a zillion different things.
Yes.
And then Pacino playing the sort of, if you will, old crusty Jewish guy. Who, you know, you can't believe this is the same guy that played Jimmy Hoffa.
He is so great.
Yeah, he really is.
He is so great. And I never, so with Al Pacino, for me, I've always been hit or miss. There are some times I felt that he overacted. I'm going to play heel on this one, but Scent of a Woman, Jeff. I hated that. I just thought he overacted. I couldn't stand him. He plays an old Jewish guy in the show, a Holocaust survivor. He has nailed the accent down. This is an unbelievable acting job, but the writing on this show, the direction on this show, everything about it, in my opinion, is it's flawless on so many different levels, because at one moment you're sucked into the fact that your hatred for what these Nazis did to innocent people and children and women, the horrible things that they did, you're totally sucked into the revenge aspect of it, which I was. The next moment, you're almost in tears based off of the storyline and the acting. And to me, that's the sign of a really, really great television show.
And since I've finished this season, I can tell you one of the things I really like is they begin to flesh out some of the supporting actors that are part of the group that you haven't really learned that much about. My favorite character in the show by season's end was Lonnie, the failed actor who every character in the story has their own redemption story by season's end. And do you have a particular favorite character? Is it Pacino or is somebody else?
It's going to be Pacino. I got to admit, spoiler alert, shut it off. All right, I'm back. When Saul Rubinek died, I was bummed. I'm like, you're really writing him out? Happy to see that at least he showed up in the next episode in a great scene, you know, which was her imagining his wife, Mindy, which I just think is great. They use a lot of Yiddish.
Oh, my God. You'll learn more Yiddish than you ever dreamed of.
It's so great. It's so great. But I really like the FBI agent who is now working with them.
Yeah.
Her name is, I think, Jerrica Hinton is an actress.
Yes. Very good.
There's a scene when she's at the funeral for Saul Rubinek's character, Murray, and she doesn't even say anything. And they show her face and I just think she's just doing a great job. This is such a good show, Jeff.
Yeah. So before we move on, trivia, Barry, do you know who plays the part of the rabbi to
Mindy
and Saul? You know who it was?
It's Josh Mostel.
Exactly. Zero Mostel's son.
Right. Who was Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof and also in a great episode of Seinfeld, Jeff, that you've recognized. But the big takeaway, episode 8, Simon Wiesenthal. Holy shit.
Yes.
You know who that was, right?
Yes, of course, from Taxi, Judd Hirsch.
Yeah. So Carol Kane and Judd Hirsch. Unfortunately, not the same scene, but I just thought that was so cool, though.
Yeah,
Was he great in that show?
Yeah, there's like these pop ins where you go, holy shit, is that? Yeah, it is. You know, and the Judd Hirsch scene was maybe a 5 or 10 minute scenes, but you know, it was really nice to see an actor like that. Okay, so strongest breaking kayfabe with Bowden and Barry recommendation on Amazon Prime: Hunters. Make an effort, seek it out, and I got to tell you, even if you don't want to watch the whole friggin' series, just watch the first 15 minutes of episode 1, and if that doesn't hook you, nothing will. Okay.
Yep.
So Barry, time to go for the go home, my friend. And as we leave, all of us, we want to just say that in our thoughts and prayers is our friend Keith McIntyre's wife, who I believe has left hospice to go home. We're anticipating not hearing good things, but we want Keith and his wife to know they're in our thoughts, they're in our prayers, and the group has your back, Keith. And we are hoping and praying for a good result for you and your wife, my friend.
Yeah, absolutely, too. And we spoke, Jeff, about this off air. And, you know, when we started this podcast, I should say, actually, when Jeff started the podcast and then I jumped on board full time after I believe it was the third episode.
Contract discussions, that kind of thing.
We were in deep negotiations. I had a strong lawyer, but I never once thought, you know, Keith said that he thanked us for the laughs over the last year or so. Or last couple of years. And I don't think anything like that ever factored into the equation. I don't think there is anything that you could say to the three of us that would be more impactful to know that we made somebody with a terminal illness smile. I think that's it. I think that's everything right there. And that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, so again, Keith, you and your wife, and our thoughts and our prayers, we're hoping for you, buddy. And so on that note, on behalf of Barry Rose, our producer, the sweet man, Luke Hippelman, out in the Bay Area, we want to say we thank and appreciate you for listening to Breaking Kayfabe with Boundary and Barry. And I will also mention that Breaking Kayfabe, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Getting close to that magic 1600 number on our board, Barry, please encourage your friends to follow us on Facebook and encourage your friends to follow us here at BowdrinPod.com. Once again, if you would like to reach out to my brother-in-law, Kent, in the rehab facility, he's part of our group. Again, big NASCAR guy. If you want to talk NASCAR with him, he's sitting there, don't have much to do, folks. So feel free to post in the group to him and talk a little NASCAR with him. I'm sure he would appreciate that. Until next week, we will return to our Lisberry 499, Barry. This is a great way to start. Fucking Lou Reed with Walk on the Wild Side. 500 songs better than Walk on the Wild Side. We'll see you next week, folks.